This is fresh air.
Now, if there were a million amateur astronomers with telescopes, and they were willing to let a few thousand people each look through their telescopes, there would be a chance for all the people in this world who wanted to see to see.
Usually, astronomy is thought of as one of the big-ticket exotic sciences. But John Dobson, now 75, calls himself a sidewalk astronomer. Once a Vedantin monk, Dobson left the cloistered life more than 40 years ago and began dragging around a simple telescope to lure curious kids into the mysteries of the heavens. He's one of the scientists featured on the six-part PBS series, The Astronomers, and he doesn't think much of the way most school kids learn about the stars by memorizing sets of constellations.
To me, the whole notion of constellations is kind of a pain in the neck. I really am not much into constellations. And they turned out to be very confusing to the astronomers. They had to have a big international meeting someplace in Europe to find out exactly where the borders of all these constellations were. Because if you give the designation, if you give a place designation, you see, according to constellation, you can't have the constellations overlap. So anyway, I don't see all those pictures up there. But you find your way around the sky by knowing where Orion is and knowing that the dagger handle points toward the North Star, and you know the Big Dipper, and you know where the pointer stars are, and you know Scorpio and a few things like that. I do know a few constellations. It's not as though I'm completely retarded, but I don't use them much, and I don't like to talk about all those stories.
So how do you get people interested in the heavens? I mean, I gather to some degree you'd like to describe the stars and the heavens as rice pudding?
That was for the universe as a whole. That's an illustration of the Big Bang model. The Big Bang model has the expansion of the universe explained as an explosion, the leftover motion from an explosion, which was 15 billion years or so ago, and all the matter of the universe was involved in that explosion, and that's why all the distant things are going away. And that can be compared, and it's not originally my comparison, can be compared to a raisin pudding in the oven. And as the pudding gets bigger and bigger, the raisins get lonelier and lonelier. As I say, so if you come too late for dinner, you get only one raisin in your spoon. But the
One raisin in your spoon, follow the metaphor.
Yeah, because the raisins get lonelier, you see. But you see, the steady state model has new raisins springing up in between. So as the raisins get lonelier and lonelier, a new raisin spring up in between. So it don't make no, never mind how late you come for dinner, there's seven or eight raisins to your spoon.
Tell us what you mean about the universe.
Well, actually, you see, when you think of these cosmological models and you see that the universe is expanding, it's not that the galaxies are getting farther and away from each other, but the clusters of galaxies appear to be getting away from each other. The raisins in our pudding are not galaxies and certainly not stars, and not even clusters of stars. They would be clusters of galaxies. On a large, large scale, the universe is expanding, but within a cluster of galaxies, we think the galaxies are not going away from each other.
But now, many of your fellow academic astronomers, when you have made these presentations, have said, well, he's a good educator, but he's a little bit out of his depth here, and a few of you have walked out of the room.
Well, I'm not very orthodox, partly because I don't think that the observational evidence supports the Big Bang very well. They have the whole universe arising from this explosion, and the explosion seems to have been very, very smooth. And the big problem is, how do you get a lumpy universe out of such a smooth explosion? Now, recently, we've discovered that when we look at the universe on the very largest scales, we find that it's the lumpiest we've ever discovered. That is to say, the matter in the universe has clumped into enormous clumps with enormous emptinesses between the clumps, and on a very large scale. And the difficulty is to explain how such a huge scale accumulation of matter could take place in such a short length of time if the Big Bang explosion was smooth. That is the big problem facing the Big Bang model right now. But there are other problems that have faced it before.
So you're the loyal skeptic. You don't throw it out altogether. But you have big questions.
I don't care really whether the universe is a Big Bang model or whether it's a steady state model. The big problem as I see it is why we see a universe at all, and what is this energy? The universe is made out of energy, and everybody knows in the physics world that we have no source for energy. We have no way to get rid of any energy, and we have no way to generate energy. We're stuck with what energy there is in the universe without an explanation of what it is or where it came from. Now, to me, that is a serious problem.
My guest is astronomer John Dobson, who has spent his life looking at, contemplating the heavens, and getting other people interested in them, too. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. John Dobson is my guest. You know, one of your friendly critics said, you know, Dobson, he's a born scientist, but the problem is he wants to reconcile religion with astronomy, and he thinks he's got the secret of the universe.
Yes.
And then science really doesn't have any room for metaphysics.
Well, you see, it does have room for metaphysics. You see, science is about how the universe works. And if you're going to assume all the first things, then you can go on and call yourself a scientist. What you have to assume is that the energy is there. You're not going to talk about what the energy is. You're not going to talk about where the energy came from, you see. That's why I used that raisin pudding example, you see. The Big Bang people don't have any source for the raisins in their raisin pudding, even though they put them all in at the beginning. The steady state people don't have any source for their raisins, even though they put them in one at a time. The problem is, where does the energy come from of which the universe is made? Now, I can't just assume all those things. Now, for the most part, the physicists have decided, the physicists and the scientists in general, have decided that we'll talk about the hows of physics and not the whys of physics. But I think the why questions are still in there. You ask, see, somebody asks, why does the electron stay near the proton? So it's because one has a plus charge and one has a minus charge. There is still the why question. Why does one have a plus charge and one have a minus charge? And why do plus and minus like each other? And why do pluses and pluses hate each other? There are all these why questions left underneath. And you ask a kid, why does something fall to the floor? He says, because of gravity. Gravity is the name of the problem, not the solution. The problem is, why is matter attracted to matter? Why is there such a thing as gravity? That's what I see as the real problems behind some of the real problems behind our physics. And because I'm willing to look at those problems, they call me a metaphysician, and like on a cigarette butt, they twist their foot and go.
But I have to give the scientists their due. I mean, the scientists are quite upfront. They say their business is how. They say their business is to describe how the clock works, not why we want a clock.
That is correct. This was more or less decided long ago by Sir Isaac Newton. He wrote a lot more theological treatises than he did physics treatises. His physics treatises became famous, and his theological treatises went to the wastebasket, I think, mostly. But at any rate, he separated in his mind the how questions for physics and the why questions for church.
Hmm. Well, when you go off to the public parks,
yeah,
at a more pragmatic level, and you bring your telescope along, what happens? What do people do? What do they say? What do they look for?
Oh, well, it depends on where we are. To a large extent, people jump up and down in glee when they get to see these things. In San Francisco, they destroyed one of the garbage cans that I used to use for a ladder by jumping up and down in joy when they saw Saturn. Now, in the national parks, where it's really dark, you can show star clusters and galaxies and gaseous envelopes around old stars. You can show a whole lot of things. We usually show the brighter objects. But for the most part, maybe one quarter of the people are flabbergasted when they see those things. There's a certain proportion of the population for whom these views are not very important, but there's a smaller proportion of people for whom it is extremely important that they got to see something outside of our solar system.
Well, but for those people who are doubtful at first, it must be, you must have an extraordinary sense of breakthrough when the doubters take a peek and see a universe they never imagined.
Well, some people, of course, are so skeptical that they don't think that what they saw through the telescope is real. I mean, quite often this happens, and then occasionally I'll get the telescope off on some distant apartment house or someplace where you can see a TV screen through the window. They know what programs are showing, and so then they know, by gum, it really is real. Then they want to see it again. Then I have to get it back on Saturn again, you see. And I also have to talk to these people about how far away these things are. While they're looking at Saturn through the telescope, I tell them that if you had a real good Mercedes diesel, and if you drove towards Saturn 60 miles an hour all day and all night without stopping for 1,200 years, you could see Saturn like that with your bare eyes.
Now, that's a technique. And
if you tell them how many miles away, there's nothing they can do in their guts that helps them on miles. But if you tell them how long it would take to drive somewhere near it in a car, that they can somehow handle. But nobody can handle 1,200 years driving.
I suppose that's sort of like the signs in Marrakesh that tell you how many camel days it takes to cross the Sahara.
Yes, right. Not how many feet it is. But I have to try to talk to people in a language which their guts can understand. See, we get fail-safe sun telescopes out in the sidewalks for people to see the sunspots. And I have to tell them that the sun is so big that there's room inside of it for the moon to orbit the Earth with 250,000 miles left to spare. It's not easy for people in their guts to understand how big the sun is or how far away it is.
John Dobson, I want to thank you for being with us today.
Don't thank me.
John Dobson is an astronomer and a teacher, and he may have a telescope near you someday. This is Fresh Air.